From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour goes back to 1985, where a young 6 or 7 year old was at his first dance, and the music was just not very good. But that's okay. It was a summer camp. It was a dance. It was a Thursday night, and there was a girl who wanted this young 7 year old to dance with her. And the song happened to be Rod Stewart's Love Touch. It did not go down as the greatest song ever written. Maybe John Kovach and others will disagree with that. But that moment became so embedded in memory that even today, that young person who has become a radio talk show host has a soft spot in their heart for Rod Stewart's Love Touch. It's a terrible thing to admit on live radio, but that's what memory and our brains can do to us. This hour, we are talking about neural nostalgia and music. I read a piece in Slate called Neural Nostalgia by Mark Joseph Stern, and his opening line had me thinking. Here it is. Why do the songs I heard when I was a teenager sound sweeter than anything I listened to as an adult? Well, it turns out there are scientific reasons for that. We're going to get into that with a panel that's going to help us have some fun this hour. John Kovach is here. He's the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester. John, nice to see you again.
My pleasure, Evan.
Dick Storms is here. He's a partner at Record Archive. Dick, nice to see you.
So great to be here. Nice to see you.
And Andrea Lewandowski is here. She is a local artist, a musician, a writer for 585 Magazine, and the token representative of technically a millennial, right?
Yeah, I'm right on the edge.
You're right on the edge. So we're trying to get slightly different generations in the studio here. And I asked everyone who was going to be joining me for the panel to think about the music they liked in their formative years, childhood through your teenage years. And I asked you, pick a song that you still love when you hear it, but you sort of admit it's probably terrible, and then pick a song that you love when you hear it and you think that holds up, that's there's something that's of high quality about that. And we're going to kind of go through some of that. But first, before we get to some of these music cuts, I'm going to start with the professor in the room. This subject was fascinating to me to hear about scientific reasons for the way our brains go there with music. Have you thought about this over the years much yourself?
Well, it's, you know, when I teach the history of rock, I often tell students, if you want to know an artist's real influences, you should find out their birth date and figure out the year of their birth, and then figure out what music was playing on the radio, was really popular between about the ages of, like, say, 12 and 17.
For that artist, yeah.
No matter what that music sounds like today, you know, them at age like 25 or 30 or something like that, you can always find traces and influence of the music they were listening to, because that seems to be, you know, for artists, for listeners, that the time when we're most impressionable, it just seems to be a stage of life. And the study that you're referring to seems to say that there are, you know, sort of real chemical and scientific reasons for that.
Which is just totally unsurprising to you, yeah. But yeah.
The other interesting thing I've found is that a lot of people's musical tastes kind of shut down after about the age of, well, 22. I mean, if you stay in music and you continue to work with music, your tastes continue to develop as you go. But a lot of people, music for them means a particular time of their life. And then once they get past about the age of 22 or so, they start to get involved in their professional lives. They haven't got as much time for music and various kinds of things like that. And so in many ways, that earlier music is a way of returning to a time that they nostalgically view as simpler, more fun, less full of responsibilities and problems. Even though if they went back to those days, they would find out that they had plenty of problems.
But is it possible, Professor? Is it possible? Every generation, once they become adults, thinks that their children's music is awful. Is it possible that that's finally true?
Well, as a scholar, I have no comment.
Okay. I didn't see a whole lot of Bieber in your archive there, Professor, but okay.
But I think he's a fantastic artist.
Okay. All right. Dick Storms, Record Archive is a landmark, okay? And so I'm curious to know, with the people who come to you at Record Archive, are they looking for pieces of their past in some ways? Not to say that there isn't modern music that you find on vinyl, but, you know, give me a sense for that.
Well, there's a tremendous market for music that strikes chords with people, that, you know, brings forth people's histories and feelings, and, you know, you hear those things. And, a lot of our customers are doing that. but my customers are all over the board, you know.
And the customers like me or folks from Andrea's age cohort, Record Archive is not just for certain folks. I mean, that's the nice thing about it. I'm always hearing about young people who get turntables for gifts, right, which is cool.
Turntables
are cool.
Yeah, it's a great trend.
So Andrea Levandusky is an artist, among other things. And so when you are working, you've said that music can impact the way you work, mm-hmm, the way that you create.
Oh, yeah. Depending on what I'm working on, I choose different soundtracks. And I recently worked on a memoir piece, so I listen mostly to music from my past to trigger memories and evoke those feelings again. But when I'm working on regular things, I set up different soundtracks to get the feeling and mood, and I listen to a lot of new music. That's the way I find a lot of new music these days.
So even at your age, you are listening to new music?
Constantly.
Okay. So you're outside the group that says after age 22, you largely stop listening to the new music.
I can't imagine listening to the same music I listened to when I was 22. I listen to it here and there, but I'm always.
But when you were 12, how about when you were 12? How about when you were 15?
That stuff doesn't even make it on my playlist anymore.
Okay.
Well, it'd be interesting to have you address that question in 15 years.
This is very
because
true.
The older you get, the more precious your younger years seem to you. You know, when they're recently passed, you can't wait to get away from them. After you've been away from them for a while, you wish you could get back there.
Let's kind of go down some of that musical lane, if we could. So I'm going to start with Professor Kovach. John, I asked you, this is the first track we're going to listen to. Was your choice for a song that still lights you up from your youth, but is maybe not something that's great. You chose Easy Livin'. What is it?
That's a track from the Uriah Heep, from the early 70s, a British group, maybe sort of a B-level band compared to groups like Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple. A fantastic guitar sound and groove at the beginning of this tune.
Well, don't give it away too much. Let's listen and we'll come back.
Let me just say that the part that is embarrassing a little bit is the middle section of the tune where the singers go into falsetto and they use orchestral bells.
I didn't pull that scene.
That's good because people will just be impressed with the awesome part of it. But it sort of jumps the shark or moves into Spinal Tap land for just a minute there. And I realize that. I love it for that. It's endearing as far as I'm concerned, but still.
Very good. All right, let's listen to a cut from Easy Livin'. Where does that take you back to, John?
It takes me back.
What's in your mind when you hear that?
The living room in my parents' home where I grew up in Livonia, Michigan, sitting down there with my black Fender Stratocaster guitar trying to work this tune out, and especially there's a little lick that follows right, which I thought was the most awesome thing, you know, along with the beginning of Smoke on the Water and the lick from Space Truck, and was absolutely the thing. So there I am sitting there next to the big record player, the big pieces of furniture where, you know, you had to sort of open the top and sort of playing that record over and over again trying to work the whole thing out.
I love it. So look at how fresh that image is still in your mind. Now, you've played plenty of covers over the years. How often have you played this? Have you played this song?
I mean, I played it at my high school bands when it was, you know, but then it really never came back.
All right, interesting. Now, Dick Storms, I have bad news. Your choice, I bungled in terms of the transcription to online. So I actually don't have the cut, but I want you to explain what bizarre song you chose from your childhood that you still enjoy, but is maybe not a classic. What did
when
you
choose? When you go into the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. When you go into the woods today, you'll never believe your eyes. For every bear that ever there was, today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic.
Do we have that, John? Do we actually do? I thought we didn't have it.
We have it in the classical 91.5.
Oh, you have the classic 91.5.
Well, it is a classic.
Very good.
It is a classic, and it was about that I was maybe 5 years old. My mother used to walk me to the Five and Dime at the corner, and they actually played demo records there, and the song just was the creepiest, scariest thing that I had ever heard in my life.
Like scary clowns,
you know,
or something.
All I'd heard until then was Glenn Miller and the Shrimp Boats Are Coming, and that song was like, whoa.
but now, even if you hear it now, it kind of puts a hop in your step.
Absolutely. I sought out the original, which is an English band from the 30s, and it's just heavy.
So, Andrea, I'm going to confess. I didn't even know that song. Did you know that song?
No, never heard it.
Does it sound a little creepy, even with the way Dick sings it?
A little bit.
A little bit. Yeah,
maybe more.
Different impacts on different people, whether you know the music or grew up with it or not. Andrea, you chose for your cheesy song from your childhood that you still love, a song from Mariah Carey.
Yeah.
You chose Always Be My Baby. Is that the name of the song? How come this one?
Oh, gosh. That song came out when I was 12 or 13, which is really formative years. And I remember exactly the first time I heard it, and I had a crush on a boy, and that's all it takes when you're that age. Boy.
I guess. Now, let's listen, and we'll find out if she's embarrassed about this. So Andrew and I are not quite the same age, but I actually remember at high school dancing to that song,
It was around for a while.
So even in my brain, it's sort of borderline acceptable.
Yeah. I feel like it's acceptable only because of nostalgia at this point.
But if you were alone and you heard that,
would you
sing along with it?
Absolutely. Yes, I would.
Okay. See? You see what's actually happened to us? I chose one that's a song on my running mix. A song in my running mix that I doubt Professor Kovach would say is a great song, but I wonder if he'd think it's sort of in the cheesy genre of decent 80s. It's Billy Idol. Let's listen to Dancing With Myself.
Oh,
all right, so that song is not only on my current running mix, but I think that's the first music video I really remember seeing. So there's a lot in my own childhood that is very positive with that. Professor, is that a terrible song or is that half decent?
No, it's fantastic songwriting. It's a fantastic piece of pop music. I love the way he's sort of doing the Buddy Holly, the sort of hiccupy kind of vocal thing. I mean, you know, the older I get, the harder it is for me to say much professionally released music is incompetent or not good. You can like it and not like it, but almost all of these performances, the song that you were talking about, I mean, what fantastic songwriting, what a tremendous production and performances.
Well, and Mariah Carey can sing. I mean, we all can agree on that.
Yeah.
She can really sing.
So. I mean, just some really talented things. And, you know, I mean, people think about a group like, say, that first Van Halen record, and they think, about how, you know, Eddie Van Halen's, you know, guitar playing, by which they mostly mean Eruption, or David Lee Ross sort of like delivery. But when you listen to the tunes on that album, there's one great pop song after another and a lot of fantastic vocals. And so, you know, there is a kind of an embrace of pop. Even if you don't like the music, you have to acknowledge that it's really, really well done.
We're talking about the music of our childhood and why it's still so delicious to us, scientifically nostalgic based, and have a great panel. John Kovach is here, the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester. He's the professor you wish you had when you were in college. Dick Storms is here, a partner at Record Archive. Andrea Levendesky is here, a local artist, musician, and a writer for 585 magazine. And we're kind of going back through the music of our pastor. Now, Dick, Billy Idol, is that all right with you?
Love that song. That's a great tune.
Will I find it on vinyl at Record
Archive? Great video, probably, yeah. Yeah, if you're lucky.
I would hope so. Now, Andrea, was that a song that you remember at all? Is that borderline for you?
That's borderline. I feel like it was re-released with, I think Glee did it a few years ago.
Glee,
and that was, honest to God, that was my first time I heard that song, modern, and I went back and listened to the original after that. So it was, I don't remember it as a child.
All right, well, you've thrown me a curveball that I'm going to actually, I'm going to go to the last song on the list there, John, because Andrea makes a point about the way music can be cycled around. And here's the interesting thing. There are sort of reincarnations of songs that are 20, 30, 40 years old, sometimes on Glee. And Glee's put out albums, haven't they? I mean, I think I've heard a great version of Don't Stop Believin' that they did, things like that. There is a guy online who's got almost a million YouTube hits for, he calls it major to minor. He takes upbeat pop music from the 80s, and then he re-records it in a dark tone. And I'm going to play this last cut on there, and I'm going to ask our panel how quickly they recognize what song this is, and then we're going to talk about why this is still actually popular today.
Some boys take a beautiful girl and hide away from the rest of the world. She wants to be the one who walks in the sun, and girls, they want to have fun.
All right, Andrea Lewandowski, immediately you gave me a thumbs up. You like it.
I love that. Wow, that's good. I want to know where I can find that. Right,
Girls Just Want to Have Fun, major to minor on YouTube. What did you think, Professor?
That's great. Fantastic.
Yeah?
Well, I'm all for the idea of musicians covering other people's music. I think it's a bit of a corner that the rock world has painted itself into, where everybody has to be doing original music all the time. Why not recycle and redo and creatively reapproach music from rock's past? Why can't that be done more often? I think it's fantastic.
I think this kind of stuff is popular because the people like me who grew up with Cyndi Lauper and Billy Idol and these things, when you hear it reimagined, it's almost a subconscious validation that what you listened to was cool and quality, even if you sort of doubt it. I mean, the original song by Cyndi Lauper is not a great song, is it, Professor?
Well, I mean, the $20 word for this in the university biz is that it's intertextual, which means the best kind of interpretation or understanding of this happens when you know the original and you can compare it against the version that you're hearing, and you kind of celebrate the dynamic and musical tension between those two. If you don't know the original Cyndi Lauper version, you hear this song in a very different way than if you're hearing the original version. And it's the fun. It's kind of like a theme and variations thing. You kind of enjoy what they're doing, and you notice the little bits and things that they do. And it's a different kind of appreciation from just hearing a song as if it was the only version of it.
See, Andrea, don't you want to take his class?
Yeah,
can we sign up for John Kovach's class at the Institute for Popular Music? Dick, that kind of music, John is saying that covers are, you know, they shouldn't be shunned. But there are some purists who think, you know, come on, you know, create your own music. Where do you fall?
I'm agnostic.
You're agnostic.
Yeah,
okay.
I like covers and I like original music. I agree 100% about covers. I love doing tunes in a minor key and messing with them like that.
Well, see, I actually like what we just heard better than a lot of covers because it is so different. Yeah, like your yeah. point there, Dick. It's a reimagining as opposed to just I'm going to play it straight the exact same way. I never fully understand why people do that.
I think that it's a mercantile decision.
I can't believe it took me that long to figure that out. Yes, it's about money. But it's the same kind of thing with movies. Why do we recreate the exact same movie with largely the same script? I mean, if you're going to reimagine something, okay. Am I being too curmudgeonly, John?
No, I like it.
No.
I like it.
And they do that all the time, making the same movie over and over again.
They do.
Yeah, yeah, that's what sequels are.
Yeah. We have an unbelievable amount of comments on the web already of people weighing in. I sparked a little bit of backlash earlier when I said that I wondered if there was any lasting quality at all from the 1990s, with the exception of a few things like Radiohead and a few more. People immediately jumped in with Pearl Jam and Nirvana and all these things. And then other people said, you can't call Nirvana pop. I mean, I think when I hear pop, John, I just mean like popular music of the time, right? That's okay.
Yeah, but you know, the word pop is coded in our discourse. Oh, I mean, he's using the $20 words again. It's coded in our discourse to basically mean sellout. So if you say something is pop, it means that somebody's just going for the money, for the lowest common denominator, to sell as many records as possible. Whereas if something is more rock or indie, that means I don't care about how much money I'm making. I'm really just doing it for myself to express myself.
Right.
Neither one of those things is ever literally true.
Right.
They're sort of an imaginary binary opposition. There are those words again. But it almost everything falls somewhere in the middle. But when you say pop to people who really sort of embrace the kind of Nirvana aesthetic, they're going to see that as, oh, you're trying to tell me Kurt Cobain was selling out. And I don't think that's exactly what you
mean. No, I don't mean it as a pejorative. I just mean the popular music of the time. So, yeah, Pearl Jam and Nirvana, Radiohead. I'm trying to think of bands from the 90s that 50 years from now will still be listened to with some reverence. Andrea, I mean, that was your life growing up there. I mean, what stands out for you in that?
Oh, boy. I feel like I didn't even get introduced to some of those bands until after they really were big on the scene. So I feel like I have a more appreciation for them now than I did then. So I listened to Radiohead a lot in the early 2000s and listened to their old stuff and really respect them now more than I even ever heard of them then. So I think there's something to coming into understanding music as an adult and then being able to go back and listen to it and appreciate and realize that was really good. So maybe I didn't listen to it when I was 15, but you know, now I'm going to carry it. I still listen to OK Computer. I don't know what year that came out, but stuff like that. I listen to it and it still hasn't gotten tired for me.
Yeah, and that's the interesting part about sort of the dichotomy of the two song selection that I asked our panel to do. A song that you know from your childhood is not great, but you still love for sort of these nostalgic reasons, but then a song that you think does hold up or does indicate quality. And that's interesting because you're circling back now as an adult saying, I do appreciate that, even if I didn't love it as a kid. That's different than saying, that's like junk food for my brain, but I can't help it. I grew up with it. You know, bop, some people, it drives them to the edge, and some people actually like it. So that kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. So I want to take a very short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about why millennials hate Bruce Springsteen. if millennials do hate Bruce Springsteen, I hope that's not true. Dick, you already look incredulous about that. But
I see millennials buying Bruce Springsteen all the time.
Okay, see? Dick's going to give us hope.
He's going to give us hope. Evidence.
We have more song cuts to play on our second half hour, and now I'll open up to you. If you want to share your musical memories, what's a song that you're sort of embarrassed to admit that you still love but you just can't help it from your childhood? And what's music from your childhood that you think does hold up and will hold up in 20, 50, 100 years? We have a wonderful panel here. I'm Evan Dawson, and you're listening to member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, we head into Labor Day weekend with a panel on the state of the modern labor movement. In New York State, the business community is hoping to scrap some laws that labor favors, and nationwide, the right-to-work movement is threatening labor. We'll talk about the value of unions and the challenges facing them Friday on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WXXI FM HD2 Rochester. Go public online with WXXI.org.
Join us for a day of fun and discovery during WXXI's Open House, Saturday, September 13th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Come meet your favorite PBS characters, take a tour of the station, and learn how to live a healthier life with free health screenings. For more information, go public at WXXI.org/openhouse.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections. We've got John Kovach in the studio, the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester, Dick Storms, a partner with Record Archive, and Andrea Levendesky, a local artist, a musician, and a writer for 585 Magazine. Your phone call's coming up here. I want to, before I move to the second sort of prong of the discussion, I do want to circle back and just say the article on Slate.com that had me thinking about this is called Neural Nostalgia, and they do cite a number of sources that are scientific. Brain imaging studies show that our favorite songs stimulate the brain's pleasure circuit, and it releases an influx of dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, and other neurochemicals. So the more we like a song, the more we actually get a chemical high out of it. And then you have Daniel Levitin, the author of This Is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, who notes that the music of our teenage years is fundamentally intertwined with our social lives. He says, we're discovering music on our own for the first time when we're young, and it often helps meld with our sense of identity, which Peter Giannata, a psychologist at the University of California, Davis, agrees with. He talks about the sociality theory of music, and they talked about really the period between 12 and 22. They say, why are our memories from these years so vibrant and enduring? Well, researchers at the University of Leeds proposed an explanation that the years highlighted by the so-called reminiscence bump coincide with the emergence of a stable and enduring self, the period between the ages of 12 and 22, in other words, the time when you become you. You buying that, Professor?
Well, the one thing you didn't point out, that the big conclusion from that study is Motley Crue really is awesome.
You don't really believe that, do you? Oh, I don't know if what the modern feminist movement thinks about the song Girls, 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 but no, there's plenty of people who still love their Motley Crue, and that's okay. Let me go ahead and take our first phone call, and then what we'll do is we'll get to more music here. Tom in Pittsburgh. Thanks for calling, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. I guess I don't know anything about any of the music you're playing so far because I'm older. But I do think... you tend to listen to the music that your parents are listening to also. But when I was a kid, when I was 13, I went up in the attic and was playing old 78 records and from the 20s. And I've liked that kind of music ever since. So that's one influence on me. So when I first heard it live, it was just fantastic. I'm talking about Dixieland in the popular term for that music, traditional jazz. But and so that's what I played. But also... I remember well the music that we danced to, you know, and who you danced with, or, you know, remember the experience of the 50s, which is songs like Nevertheless by Nat King Cole, or So Tired, or songs like that, which none of you guys know, probably.
No, I know some of those tunes. I'm sure Dick can tell you. You could probably find plenty of that in Dick's shop, right?
You can find plenty of it. You can find plenty of it in my collection. I absolutely love the classic American Songbook. And
you didn't talk about the Great American Songbook, which, of course, it includes all show music and things, too, which we listen to a lot.
And we spent a wonderful hour here with Michael Lasser talking about the Great American Songbook and the great work that he's done on that. Thanks for the call, Tom. He is saying... that millennials don't hate Bruce Springsteen, essentially. He's saying that this notion that we always hate what our parents listen to is not necessarily true, and actually what our parents listen to can help be formative for us. So, Andrea, do you listen to what your parents listen to?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, my dad raised me listening to Gordon Lightfoot, John Denver, those guys, and a lot of those old tunes. And he introduced me to Billie Holiday when I was a kid. I still listen to Billie Holiday. He has a great music library and kind of handed it to me, and I feel like that shapes a lot of what I listen to now.
I tend to agree with that. I remember, you know, being a kid and listening to the whole album of Born in the USA, not at all understanding the politics, which are sort of ironic that now it's sort of this American anthem. But I grew up in Cleveland, and at Municipal Stadium, 80,000 people stood on chairs to try to get a look at Bruce Springsteen. My dad goes to that show, and I still love that. So I guess, John, you don't think millennials necessarily hate Bruce Springsteen?
Well, I don't know. I think it changes by generation. The generation that I grew up in, I graduated in 1977 from high school. You wouldn't have caught most of us dead listening to our parents' records when we were that age. Now later, you
oh,
go
so
back
that's a rebellion at the
them.
Time.
Oh, come on! I mean, who? I have classes full of students who want to know about the music of the Beatles, which you know was all done and recorded way before they were even born, but. In 1975, who could have done a class and gotten a bunch of kids my age interested in the music of Bing Crosby or the music of Frank Sinatra? Even Elvis was considered too far in the past. So we defined ourselves by listening to music that our parents didn't, and that was sort of a marker of our generation. I think today you've got a lot of kids who first came to classic rock through their parents and their parents' record collections, so there's that experience. But you've also got kids who, you know, they like, you know, they liked Marilyn Manson because their parents hated it, or there's certain kinds of rap that they like because they know their parents are going to hate it. So it can still be a marker of difference for them. But I think, you know, this the current generation, I think, is much more of a magpie generation than mine was. I mean, in my high school class, if somebody had 50 records and you had five people, each with 50 records, they probably had the same 35 records, and the extra 15 records were what kept them apart. If you look at the playlists on kids' devices now, I think you'd find that there'd be not a considerable amount of overlap. They listen to a lot of different kinds of things and are much less likely to be sort of slotted as a particular kind of consumer. It's caused a fracturing of the music industry, and part of it's had to do with the availability of this music digitally.
I think that's a great point. But, Dick, you said you still got millennials who come in looking for Bruce Springsteen at Record Archive.
Yeah, Bruce Springsteen is still popular, and they're looking for Bruce Springsteen vinyl. You know, they want the vinyl. So, yeah, I think that he still has a lot of traction. He's a muscular performer, and he's still out there on the road. And you look at the crowds at his concerts, and there are a lot of young people. I know that goes against what the article was saying, but in fact, a lot of young people go to see him.
I think the Slate article is much better than the Salon article. The Salon article that claims millennials hate Bruce Springsteen. I'm glad to hear. But I think John makes an interesting point that in that rebellious time, maybe we reject it reflexively and then start to appreciate it a little bit later. You know, that makes sense to me. Makes sense to you, Dick?
I think a lot of it is a reaction to your parents hating your music.
So I'm going to hate their music.
There's a bit of payback there.
Yes, that's.
But I grew up listening to, I guess, Glenn Miller when I was a child, and I really have no interest in Glenn Miller now. But I do like swing. But I went out and found my own swing. I went out and found Louis Jordan and Louis Prima, and later Louis Armstrong. I did all the Louis.
You had the market cornered. Love it. All right, let's get back to the phones. This is Steve in Penfield. Steve, thanks for calling Connections.
Thank you for taking my call. My original thought was one of the greatest songs of rock and roll in my mind, and I'll say that I'm 60 years old, is White Rabbit, as played originally by Grace Slick with the Grace Society and later by the Airplane. And I have a question for anybody who has an answer. You know, a lot of bands are doing covers of other bands' songs, but back in the olden days, they didn't do that. They made remakes. I'm just wondering when the transition from remakes to covering happened.
Steve, thanks for the call. What's the difference between a remake and a cover, John?
Well, I don't know if I would call them so much remakes, but that's, I understand what you mean by that. The idea that back in the early days, even extending really into the late 60s, once a song would start to get hot on the charts, other artists would immediately do their own version of it. Maybe not, you don't so much want to exactly copy the other record because, you know, you want to put your own distinguishing characteristic on it. But, you know, a famous story, we think about the Byrds as being one of those kinds of groups. You know, they're doing Dylan, but how could you possibly copy the Byrds? Well, actually, All I Want to Do, Baby, Be Friends With You, the follow-up to Mr. Tambourine Man, was knocked off the charts in a version by Cher, of all people. And it wasn't really considered a ripoff. I mean, Dylan said to Roger McGuinn, how could you let this happen? But still, the idea that you would just do it was the song, not a particular performance of it. But once recording starts to become so important, who wants a cover album of Sgt. Pepper? You know, you want the original recording the Beatles did. Then there starts to become a real strong connectedness between a song and a particular performance of it. And now to do a cover, you have to do something significantly different because you don't want to be seen as just trying to rip off or take advantage of somebody else's recording.
All right, so on that thought, I'm going to grab the song choice that Dick chose for the music from his childhood that he is essentially a little more proud of that does hold up. So Tiffany and others, if you're waiting to join the conversation, we're going to get to you in just a second. But first, let's listen to Hound Dog. It is not Elvis Presley. Let's listen to Hound Dog.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. You told me you was high.
There are going to be some members of the audience, maybe Andrea, who've never heard that version. What is it, Dave?
That's Big Mama Thornton, 1953. She was a star on the Chitlin circuit, and she had a gigantic hit in that world with that tune. You know, it was written by a couple of young kids from L.A., Lieber and Stoller. Maybe we've heard of them. And it was their first big hit. They had to have their mom co-sign for them to get the publishing for the thing. And of course, later it was picked up by Elvis and turned into a huge, you know.
Elvis turned it into a thermonuclear hit. But I love that version. And Andrea, have you ever heard that before?
I've never heard that before.
What did you think?
Wow, I actually had goosebumps. That was awesome.
Yeah, it is wow.
That's really great.
Yeah, yeah.
What did you think, Professor?
There's a great story that Mike Stoller tells about that when he found out that Elvis's song, version of Hound Dog, was a hit. And of course, once they had a hit, they became the hot songwriter, and that kind of launched their career. But the interesting thing is that the version Elvis did was not the Big Mama Thornton version. It's a version he had heard a Las Vegas singer doing, where the lyrics had already been changed, and Jerry Lieber, you know, used to be insistent, saying, you know, I never wrote "You Ain't Never Caught a Rabbit and You Ain't No Friend of Mine." That's not my lyric, and I won't take responsibility for it.
But you take the royalty, right?
Well, take it, yeah. Just send it.
What a great choice from Dicta. This is Tiffany in the city. Tiffany, thanks for calling. City of Rochester, thanks for calling Connections.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead, Tiffany.
Hi. Oh, my gosh. So it's just really goofy listening to this and hearing what a lot of I just feel like it was so strange how I was raised by my parents, because they didn't raise me on just like the normal things. I mean, I would say like I'm in my maybe late 20s or so, and I would tell people, oh, my favorite band is the Rippingtons. Oh, my favorite album is Donald Fagen's The Nightfly. And my friends would just look at me so goofy, like, what is that? I mean, I just think it's so funny whenever I hear like, oh, so like this was the music that we were raised on. But then I was like, my parents were listening to jazz, and I didn't really, I guess, get a lot of exposure to pop music until I was about 9 or 10 years old.
That's interesting. But your experience is a little less common, obviously.
Yeah.
So, Tiffany, thanks for the call. John, when you've got someone who doesn't even really get exposed to pop till 9 or 10, I guess you can only like what you hear.
I guess that's right, too. And, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is how people can continue to have nostalgic relationships with music that they learned after those teenage years. So, for example, when I was in music school at the University of Michigan, my dissertation thing was 12-tone music. Now, you might think there's a music that nobody really wants to listen to, but I was a 12-tone fanatic, went to Vienna to study, all kinds of things like that. Well, you know, it's happened in recent years. I'm in my 50s now, that I'll hear, strange as it may seem, the beginning of Schoenberg's Variations for Orchestra and get all nostalgic about my 80s days back at Michigan. So you think it's got to be sort of pop, but people who've grown up with classical music can often have all these same, it doesn't really matter what the style is, it's that it's music and that the music was important at a particular time in a particular way.
Pretty cool, though, that Tiffany was growing up weaned on her parents' music, and that was the only choice. I mean, I guess no wonder she's nostalgic for that kind of music. I want to listen to poor John, our engineer, is just busy fielding so many calls, and it's nice to have the interaction from the audience. Next, we're going to listen to John Kovach's music choice. You chose a couple of songs that do hold up. I chose the easy audience one.
Right.
Hard Day's Night.
Okay, awesome.
Why did you choose this one?
Well, this one, first of all, there's not a bad song on A Hard Day's Night. It's a fantastic record. It's so full of John Lennon and that early energy and everything the Beatles were. I think it's probably their best commercials, you know, Lennon-McCartney as songwriters record. It's fantastic. And, of course, I was, you know, 5 years old at the time. We listened to this record on one of those record players where you would tape a nickel to the tone arm, and I would listen to the record and jump on the bed. So
let's listen
to that's the energy.
Hard Day's Night and think about John jumping on the bed.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog. It's been a hard day's night. I should be sleeping like a log. But when I get home to you, I find the things that you do will make me feel alright. You know I work all day to get your money.
All right, so John and Dick are a little closer to that generation of music, and I'm curious to know, I'll start with John on this, for the people who talk about what great music is, mm-hmm. sometimes there is a bias against the earlier Beatles before they get a little bit more diverse in their soundings, but the Hard Day's Night, for you, is classic.
Fantastic songwriting. I mean, if you're not going to like A Hard Day's Night, you're not going to like most of Phil Spector's records or Lieber and Stoller's records with the Coasters and things like that. That's fantastic music. People get too wrapped up in this kind of, you know, musician as artist saying something important kind of thing. And, you know, if you want to live in that world, that's awesome. I hope you enjoy it there. But for me, it's a little bit too narrow way to view music.
What do you think, Dick? Mm.
I think that's a great tune, and I think that the production is remarkable. I think that it's really one of the first points at which you hear George Martin's profound influence on the band. It brings together the full weight of what great production could be in that period.
I could listen to them just talk about Beatles. And we have. John's actually been here talking about Beatles. He's taught a class on the Beatles. This is Sean in Seneca Falls. Sean, thanks for calling Connections.
Hi. I grew up in the 80s, and we got bombarded with a lot of the music from the 80s, so we ended up hating the music from the 80s. I still hate Rick Astley. The Rick Roll song is the worst. And I want to ask your professor there
yeah.
popular music about the music that people hate.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you had Mariah Carey on just a minute ago, and I work in a food service job, and that song gets played on like a Guantanamo Bay torture frequency. and I'm stuck there listening to stuff like that.
Now, Sean, before I kick it over to Professor Kovach, let me ask you briefly. You're talking about the music that you grew up hating that you still hate. Is there music that you grew up loving that you still love?
It's stuff that I ended up hating that I still hate. And I'm 43, and I listen to dubstep, for one thing. So I'm not really typical, but a lot of this stuff, just the schlock then is schlock now. seriously.
Sean, hold it there. Let me kick it over to John. And thanks for the call. It's the Guantanamo Bay torture line may be the line of the week on this program. Well done, Sean.
As a fan or a listener, it's certainly possible to hate any kind of music, to find it irritating, entire styles, particular artists. It happens all the time. For any artist you can choose as your favorite artist, there's at least one person in the world who thinks that music is awful and thinks the world would be better if it were just eliminated entirely. It's also possible for music that you like to be so overplayed that you start not wanting to hear it anymore. I mean, you know, we talk about great pieces like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or Beethoven's Third Symphony, but you talk to most members of major orchestras who've played in those orchestras for 20 years, and they could live the whole rest of their lives without ever hearing that piece again because they've played it so many times. And nobody's sort of, you know, that's their reaction because of their experience. So you can ruin any good thing. And a bad thing you don't have to ruin because it's already bad.
It's already bad. You know, there's I think, Sean, we all agree with the point there. We don't grow up loving everything that is popular at the time. I think part of this discussion is more just about whatever we do latch onto in our childhood, why does it impact us the same way 20, 30, 40, 50 years later? And so, but I guess it still impacts us negatively. I mean, Dick, there's got to be stuff you grew up listening to loathing that you loathe to this day.
No.
No?
No, I really enjoy a lot of the buffet of music I've been served up. You know, there are things that were overplayed, but, you know, luckily I've been insulated from having to listen to pop radio because I've always, because of what I do, been able to select my own music. And so I can just explore, so it's not really an issue.
Andrea, what did you grow up loathing that you still loathe?
Oh, boy. I'd have to think about
that. See, I think for some it's easy. For some, you know, you just don't listen to it.
There's nothing that comes to mind off the top of my head.
Yeah, for me, it's a little bit of the bubblegum pop that's kind of that started to filter in more perniciously in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s, I guess. Dick? You wanted to jump in there?
Oh, no, I'm just thinking of the bubblegum pop of the 70s. I mean, the Archies is just genius.
Yeah. I like the Archies. Are you being facetious?
No.
What's wrong with the Archies?
Are you going to stand up for Donny Osmond and Puppy Love?
No, that I will not stand up for.
Captain and Tennille, Muskrat Love.
Well, yeah.
Muskrat
Love was a great pop tune, yeah.
We got to draw the line in the sand.
In a certain sense, they're all great, right? Yeah. I mean, they're successful, and it's not so easy to
It was all those L.A. That was still in the days of the L.A. supergroup.
Right, yeah.
backing them. So right. It was, yeah.
But come on, John, you're the professor, and so you've been saying that you at least appreciate that if they're successful, they're well-produced records. But there's got to be stuff that drives you crazy.
Yeah, but that's a fan reaction. I mean, as a scholar and a historian, you need to train yourself to try to not let – you're a little bit like a judge in a court. You know, you may like a defendant or not like a defendant, but you can't let that – determine the way in which you rule. And I think the older you get, you know, Dick and I are talking about, the older you get and the more you're sort of in music all the time, the more you just approach everything you hear on its own terms. And you
yes.
don't expect something
yes.
to be something else,
yeah.
you know. And
yeah.
if you do that, it's just like yeah. dealing with people, you know. If you accept yeah. everybody for who they are and on their own yeah. terms, it's hard to hate anything, really, unless it's constantly in your
and
face.
And it's hard to like yeah. too much if everything gets compared to the
Beatles.
You just drift
to that aesthetic parallax view that's required of you to
yeah.
to see that piece and understand and enjoy that piece.
All right, let's get a little bit more, one more phone call and a little bit more music to round out the hour. Michael, go ahead, Michael in the city of Rochester. Michael, are you there?
Hello.
Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, actually, my name is Andrew.
Oh, Andrew, nice to have you on, Andrew.
I'm a local musician. As a matter of fact, I saw Dick at the Fairport Music and Food Festival the other day. Hi, Dick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm more in line with where Dick was coming from in two particularly very important ways. One is that music taste and taste itself can be like a wake behind a boat. It broadens behind you as you go forward in time to the point where I now really enjoy music that I loathed as a high school student.
Hmm.
And that gets to my second point, which is that there's a whole portion of people out there, and growing every day, I think, nowadays, that the music industry has fractured a little bit, and that is that are esoteric, that are very broad in their enjoyment. I particularly cannot stand the new rock country, but it's not that I can't stand the music. As a musician, the music is fine. Melody lines are great. But I don't like the music because of its cultural movement through the 80s, the Rush Limbaugh, the conservative growth. The new country just feels like they're selling me a style of life that I don't particularly agree with. Now, I'm somebody who is just practicing a Bach piece at home. I play all kinds of rock and roll on stage. And I love reggae and punk and jazz. And so it's really the breadth of it, I think, that defines this wonderful dynamic country and culture. And the more broad we get, and the less we can define people by their particular decade, the more rich we become as musical lovers.
I think that's wonderfully said, Andrew. Thank you for the call. And to Andrew's point about the broader we get in terms of our appreciation, that's exactly what John's saying about the current generation. They're not going to be boxed as easily because there's so many options instantly available with modern technology and the music industry. Well, Andrea's choice for a song that she thinks holds up well, this is okay, don't flinch, because in many ways the song makes me sad because of the sad end of the life of Whitney Houston, but she could really sing. Mm-hmm. And you chose I Will Always Love You, and let's listen.
And I will always love you.
I just get more sad when I hear her voice now. What do you feel, Andrea?
Yeah, I feel sad. It's the story of her life even just makes me sad. And the song itself is, I think it's a beautiful piece. The way she sings it is incredible. Her voice is amazing. I really admire her as a singer. She just...
And was there a boy in the background of this one for
actually,
you?
Actually, no.
Oh!
This is just... I grew up singing a lot, and I loved trying to match my breath control with hers on this piece. I just felt like she was a goddess. I just didn't even understand how she could hold some of those notes without flinching. And so this song kind of solidified for me the power of a voice. And she's like a natural, her dynamics naturally as a singer are just amazing to me.
Mm-hmm. What interesting points there. And John and Dick, she's different than the Beatles, but 50 years from now, I bet you people will still appreciate her voice.
Oh, the emotional content in her voice is just amazing. You know, she's obviously a sensitive artist who brought it.
Yeah. And when you come back to what we were talking about before, you know, Whitney Houston wasn't a singer-songwriter. She was a singer. She was a virtuoso singer. Someone else did her arrangement. Someone else did the production. Someone else wrote the songs. But she brought a performance to bear. That's just, you know, it's just breathtaking. You listen to her the way you would listen to a great opera singer or something like that. They don't write their own music either, but they turn in these fantastically inspiring performances, and that's who she was.
Real briefly, let's listen to my choice. This is people have even said, well, some people get Radiohead and some don't. But for me, Fake Plastic Trees defines a time in my life growing up where I thought, at least I won't be embarrassed about this one in the future.
The green plastic watering can for a fake Chinese rubber plant and a fake plastic girl.
Now, the hard part about that is if you're just hearing that, the song has a great emotional arc to it that you're not getting there, but I'm proud of that one. Andrea?
So good. And that brings me back to 2 weeks ago, and that song is still in my playlist. It's I love it.
See?
There's
common ground we're finding. That's good. Closing thoughts. Professor Kovach, we've had a fun talk about music, but all we've learned this hour is that music is still the emotional connective tissue of our lives.
Yeah, I think that's right. My parting shot to folks would be try to love as much music as you can on its own terms, and I think your life listening to music is much richer for it.
Dick Storms?
I'll end with a question. What's with falsetto singing in American pop music?
Oh, Dick. Andrea, closing thoughts.
I'd say with as much music that's at our fingertips these days, especially my generation, I feel like the more we can listen to, the better. From all span of time, just search on YouTube, Spotify, anything, find the music and listen to it.
The song you're hearing right now is Ra Ra Riot, by the way. Mm-hmm. And you can find it. It's called Shadow Casting. It's actually on my list as well now, too. And they're more of a modern. And I, even in my advancing age, have discovered them. And someday soon, I'd like to have them on this program. They're from the Geneva, Syracuse area. And they do some nice work with strings in modern popular music. Andrea Levandusky, you can find her work in 585 Magazine and many other places. Nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dick Storms, Record Archive. It's a landmark. Great talking to you.
Great. It was great. Thank you.
All right, and John Kovach, I could talk to you about music all day long. He is with the director of the Institute for Popular Music at the University of Rochester. Thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
And thanks to John Andrus behind the glass. See you Friday.